Now, verse 26. Likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness, for we don't know how to pray as we ought. But that very Spirit intercedes with sighs too deep for words. Allow me just to go to the side a little bit. I've been in charismatic groups quite a bit as a teacher and as someone saying mass and so on for many years, though I've never been in a charismatic group, and nor do I have the gift of glossolalia or singing or speaking in tongues. So I'm now talking kind of as an observant outsider in a way. But I think, if I've understood it, I've said this at all kinds of national meetings on this business, and people have thought I might be right, people who are charismatic, so I don't know about that, but I'll try this. Let's go back to that sentence. The Spirit intercedes with sighs too deep for words. What happens when the Spirit intercedes with sighs too deep for words, I think, is determined by the group, by the psychic expectations of the group. If you go back to Teresa of Avila, say, when she thought, meditated, talked about God in her head, said things to God out of a book or out of her mind, you see, you're still in control when you're doing that, aren't you? You're actually doing the talking. Well, hopefully, when God actually takes over a bit, you come, as you do in love, or anything in our life, you get to a point where words can't say it anymore, like words just don't hold it. So you go into silence. That's fine. Sometimes we all go into that. Any of your grandparents maybe, and when your first grandchild came, you probably had nothing to say. You just took the little darling in your arms and were filled with joy, kind of, whatever. I can't guess, but do you know what I mean? The words aren't what's appropriate. And that's why we've got art, all kinds of art. But it's also why we've got silence. Now, Teresa of Avila and the general tradition in our church in most cultures, when we don't know how to pray as we ought and the Spirit intercedes with sighs too deep for words, most of us go into silence. She would call it the prayer of quiet. Any other name will do, but prayer of quiet. So you might have had meditating, Ignatian method of prayer, and they're all good, of course. But then you might come to a place one day where you say, Lord, have mercy. And that, let's say that might last you half an hour. Because you haven't really... That's what you're saying, Lord, have mercy. That's it. So you're in a place where that's the mood, and it's beyond words now. Or it might be thank you, and that's all it is. Or it might be me and you in me, and you're just there, silently, in prayer. You're in prayer, but you're not saying anything that's getting in the road. That's what most do. I think it's the same experience when it's genuine in a charismatic group, where a person who's been worrying, thinking, they have a deep, profound experience of the Spirit of Jesus, and it takes them away from their head, and their thoughts, and their words, and their prayers, and their trimmings and all that, and it takes them, but now, because of the group expectation, they say, whatever they've heard from somebody else. So it's not a language, it's just babble, it's a baby talk, it's just nonsense. But the difference between me going like this you don't know what I'm doing, do you, when I do that? You can make your assumptions. But it's silence, and it's very hard to access. But when someone says, it catches a bit. It's like contagion. It's like something that people can pick up. I suspect that's what happens. And if you're in the Southern Baptist in America, you'll do one thing. And if you're in a little group in Adelaide, you'll do another. And if you're So if it's genuine, and it isn't always. Of course, no prayer is always genuine, any kind of prayer. I suspect that what's at the heart of the charismatic movement is this verse. It's an experience of being something more beautiful has come to release us from having to be the ones doing all the praying. And you go wherever you go with that. And if you belong to the tradition I was trained in, you'll go into silence and you won't do that. But others go do that, and you have to respect it and perhaps be helped by it. And God, who searches the heart, knows what is the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to the will of God. We know that all things work together for good for those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. Now you're in for probably a surprise. To use the expression loving God is hardly new to us. John's letters and gospel are full of it. And of course it all goes back to, that mightn't be exactly the best way to put it, Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 to 5. This is one of the key, this is the central prayer of Israel. And this is the one they put in their phylactery that they wrap around here and on their arm. And on the mezuzah here on the door, it's one of the texts inside that little container there. And because this is what the prayer is. Deuteronomy 6, 4. Listen, Israel. Now listen. The Lord is our God, the Lord alone. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. Keep these words that I'm commanding you today in your heart. Recite them to your children. Talk about them when you're at home and when you're away, when you lie down and when you rise. Bind them as a sign on your hand. Fix them as an emblem on your forehead. Write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Okay, thou shalt love the Lord thy God. So of course you'd expect loving God to be a key New Testament concept. Interestingly, Paul uses the expression love God three times in his 13 letters, which ought to initially cause a surprise. There's one, that's why I've been talking about it. Those who love God. There's two more. What no eye has seen, this is a quote too probably, what no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the human heart conceive, what God has prepared for those who love him. 1 Corinthians 2:9. And also in 1 Corinthians 8:3, anyone who loves God is known by him. You see, Paul, of course the truth is there, but Paul doesn't use the word love for what we do for God. And there's an insight in this that's worth getting. For Paul, love is what God does for Jesus. Love is what Jesus does for us. Love is what we do for each other. Our response to God and to Jesus, all over the place, hundreds of times in Paul, is faith. That's the word he puts for that. Believe, welcoming grace. In other words, love is what God is. Love is what initiates something beautiful. And we can initiate beautiful things for each other. But in regard to God, I don't think I'm overplaying this, Paul's favourite way of looking at that is to welcome grace, to believe. Because God is doing it, and we're welcoming it from God. He wouldn't argue with John about it, but his language is so, so different. And maybe for us in our English situation, where the word love has been so debased, I suppose it's still beautiful, but it's also debased, so it's a tricky word, wherein people sometimes, we can all think this, people might think they should feel loving towards God, and they're not sure they are, because they feel fairly cold almost, or neutral or something. It's not a bad way to be, by the way, but they think that it isn't so good. It's very important to remind us all that love, even the way Jesus uses it and the Bible uses it, is not actually about feelings at all. There's nothing wrong with feelings being there. They're not bad, of course. But love is, for example, Jesus says, love your enemies. He doesn't say, feel loving towards them. Love them means, he goes on to say what it means, pray for those who persecute you. Be kind to those who are, etc., etc. Be like your father, the rain. So love is something, it's commitment to action. It's commitment to doing something. I was hungry. He doesn't say, and you felt really nice about me. He says, you gave me something to eat. That's love. So love is actually what we actually do, however we feel. Get it? And hate, which is the opposite to love, is not choosing to do. It doesn't mean, in the biblical sense, love, hate. It doesn't mean you feel lousy towards someone. It means you don't do good to them, or you don't choose them. So it's about commitment, decision. I hope that's clear. So probably it's not bad to think in terms of God, because some people think loving God. No, maybe you don't feel anything with regard to God. But if you, as Jesus said, I've one commandment, love one another. Now you're getting into something. Do good to one another, however you feel. Feelings have got to be allowed to be very gently allowed and listened to, but not trumped up or not expected, I think. Well, I'll leave all that because I'm no psychologist about it, but the fact is that Paul doesn't do it, doesn't use that word as his favourite word. Now we get onto a very important theology. I'll read the text first. Those whom God foreknew, Greek prognosko, forget the rest, he also predestined, prohorizo, we get our word horizon from that, prohorizo, to be conformed to the image of his son, in order that he might be the firstborn with a large family. And those whom he predestined, he called. Those he called, he justified. Those he justified, he glorified. Now, I want to save you from bothering with libraries full of arguments which are all dead, finished, gone. They don't exist anymore, except in books that don't read, are written by people who don't read. You might have heard in your youth about predestination. You might have been involved in with people who argue that some people are predestined for heaven and some people are predestined for earth, for hell. I just like to wipe all that out of your head easily. But you'll have to listen to me because I'm going into a bit of philosophy. How's your brain? Oh, not good. You want to stand up for a minute and then see if you can... Okay. Greek prepositions are primarily spatial, local. That's where you start. Other uses are analogical. It's used in many ways, but it's always very good to bring it down to the spatial first and then work from it. So, I am speaking before you, aren't I? I'm before you. I'm in front of you. I'm here before you. But I'm not speaking yesterday and you're listening today. It's not a temporal before, it's a spatial before. So, and that's what we're doing. A prophet is someone who speaks before, meaning he speaks, proclaims, which is the same as the Latin for the Greek. So it's the same word, profemi in Greek and proclamo in Latin. It means you proclaim something from God now to real people now about their real life now and its implications, of course, for the future. But it doesn't mean you look into a crystal ball and imagine something. So, when we say God foreknows or foredestines, prokonginosko or prohorizo, we're talking about ontological priority, not temporal priority. God doesn't exist in time. Once you use time words of God, you've got to know that you can't do anything else because that's the way your brain is structured. But you've got to, every time, you've got to put a line through it and say, that's wrong thinking. God is. We're the ones with this funny thing, it's quite funny really, where we're becoming all the blooming time. And if you try and stop it, you can't. Because as soon as you stop it, you're on to the next bit. You put your pin in the butterfly, it's dead. But if the butterfly's going to live, you just got to keep it moving. There's no way for us to stop time, is there? So we're becoming all we are, and only our present moment is real, because our present moment engages the presence of God. We are. We're being breathed forth from God now. We don't ever have anything but a now, but our now keeps shifting. God's doesn't. God is. So when we say God foreknew, we don't mean he knew yesterday, because there's no yesterday with God. We mean that God's knowledge is prior. That's the thing we've got to look for, to our knowing. Our knowing is a response. It's a being engaged in something. But it's what God knows that is the real reality. Are you with me? That's prior to, in ontological reality and importance and every other thing, but not in time. Just wipe that out of your brain. There's no time. So God predestines means what, no matter what we're destining, no matter what we're planning, no matter what my designs might be or my yeses or nos are going on, Paul wants to look at what is God's design, what is God's will now. And there is only a now. In fact, there's only a now for us too, because the future doesn't exist till it's now, does it? So the now is what is. The sacrament of the present moment is not a bad thing. It can be very painful, but it's very real. But that's all we've got, so we better live it. So all these four in God isn't when I was a little baby, God had a plan for me, and now whatever I do, I'm going to end up where God wanted me to end up. That's a bizarre idea. It's philosophically bankrupt, and it's theologically bloody heresy of an appalling nature. But people did argue about it, because they hadn't thought it through philosophically, see? That's why the Pope keeps insisting, and he's dead right, philosophy in the training of clergy, training of anybody, metaphysics is the most important thing to do for any of us, looking for meaning. And if the world stops looking for meaning and just becomes practical, you end up where a lot of the world is ending up. Power, dominating, and all the rest of it. We've got to search for meaning, and that's the task of the love of wisdom, which is philosophy. So as we think these things through, I hope I've been clear with you. I can't think I can say it any clearer. Those whom God knew, but God's knowledge is prior to anything we ever know, in ontological priority. Are you with me? Being. Well, look at the word know now. It's a beautiful word in the Bible, right through. And don't ever forget this. It's not intellectual knowledge only, though that's part of it, of course. What we think is terribly important. But we all know that what we think in reality, what we think is very important, because we've got to think straight rather than crooked. But reality is well beyond anything we can think. The word know in the Bible is the knowledge that one has through intimacy. It's actually ultimately a sexual image. Adam knew Eve and they begot Cain, Abel, you know. Knowledge. It's about knowing what you know. Think of anything you know because you're in love. It can be in the mystical prayer. It can be a child relationship. It can be a husband-wife relationship. It can be a priest and anybody. You know what I mean? And you know a lot through intimacy, but you don't know it. You can't put words on it always, but you know it. And there are some people around who have never been to school, would think they are very unclear, and they know so much because they're in touch. So this is, I have known Abraham. I knew you, says God. Intimate. You only have I known of all the families of the earth. Anyone who loves God is known by God. And here, most beautifully perhaps, Galatians 4:9, trust Paul to put his finger right on it. Now, however, that you've come to know God, or rather, be known by God, which is exactly what he's saying when he says foreknew. You know God, or rather, God knows you. That's the most important thing. That's prior. Yours is a response, an acceptance of love, an embracing of it. Well, here we are. So he predestined. Paul is wondering, what is God's design? Before we start mucking around about us, what does God's design? What's in place that we need to embrace or respond to? It's to be conformed to the image of his Son. In order that we might be the firstborn, he might be with a large family. Those he predestined, he called. Those he called, he justified. Meaning, set them right. Two things justify can mean. One, he made us, put us into a right relationship with himself through Christ. So we're brought into the right relationship, and justify can also be used as a legal term. We're declared to be in that statement. God's judgment is that you are in a right relationship with him. But as I said last week, God's judgment is not wrong. So if God says you are in a loving relationship with him, you are. He's not playing games, neither are you. It's not a pretense. It's real, because God has changed you, changed us, changed Paul, transformed us into the image of his Son, that we may share his glory. Now I can hurry to an end of this. What are we going to say about all this as Paul, and this is the end of his key section. If God is for us, who's against us? He didn't withhold his own Son, but he gave himself up for all of us. Won't he give us everything else as well? And he's playing with these texts from the Bible, which you'll see. Isaiah 50, he who vindicates me is near, who will contend with me? Let's stand together. Who are my adversaries? Let them confront me. It's the Lord God who helps me. Who will declare me guilty? It's kind of the same thing he's saying now, but in a Christian setting. With God at my side, says Psalm 118, what do I fear? What can human beings do to me? Verse 33 to 36. Who will bring any charges against God's elect? Meaning those that God has chosen. Don't limit it. Don't for the moment, we'll see Paul will make it very clear later. Don't think he's chosen a few and not going to choose the others. Just leave it. Those whom God has chosen. Later we're going to find he's chosen everybody. That's the whole Christian message. And then the next bit, since there's no punctuation in Greek, you can't tell whether it's a statement or a question, and it's just an arguable thing. It's a literary thing, really. The New Revised Standard Version quite rightly puts it down as a statement. I don't know, but from a dramatic point of view, I think it's actually better to see it as a question, because the people are doing the answering. He's not telling them something. I think he's asking them something. Is it God who justifies? And of course they say yes. Well, who's going to condemn? Is it Christ Jesus who died? Yeah. Who was raised? Who's at the right hand of God? Who intercedes for us? And the answer to all those questions is, of course. Well, who's going to separate us from the love of Christ? The love that he has for us. Hardship, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, the sword. It's written, for your sake we're being killed all day long. We're accounted as sheep to be slaughtered. Well, no, says Paul. In all these things we are more than conquerors, not from our own energy, but through him who, another important Greek point, I don't want to tell you even though I guess it's a bit hard. They translated in New Revised Standard Version, through him who loved us. Now I'm going to tell you something true, but a lot of scholars still haven't caught up with this. It's debated, it's not debated, it's just not known by some. And it's one of the most important things I was taught by the Jesuit who taught me, and I'm so grateful because it makes a terrific difference to the way you look at texts. The Greek here is an aorist participle. Well, if you don't know what that is, I can't tell you. I just hope you know a bit of Latin or something. So it's a participle, and it's in the aorist form. Now, the aorist participle, when it's finite, when it's talking about actual actions, is always with regard to the past, and it's always just stating what happened in the past. It doesn't nuance it. It doesn't say what I was doing, what I used to do. It says what I did. Just simple, without qualification. That's what the aorist is for. Otherwise, they use the imperfect or other perfect or other forms. You with me enough to know what I'm saying? That's in the finite thing. When you get to the participle, the infinitive or the imperative aorist, it's very important to know that that is the unnuanced participle, no nuances, the unnuanced imperative and the unnuanced infinitive. When it's aorist, means a is negative. It's got no qualifications. It's an unqualified participle. So when you're studying Greek, if you find the participle is aorist, there's nothing to say about it. You just know that that's what is just the aorist participle. If you use the present participle or the perfect participle, you have to say why. There's some reason for it. There's some reason for moving into a nuance. What is the nuance? You've got to look for it. Sorry for all that. But the conclusion of all that is that in English, our unnuanced form is the present continuous. So Paul is not saying here, through him who loved us, so we've got to find out when did he love us. And they'll say it when he was on the cross, like it's particularly talking about something he actually did in the past. It's not, it's a participle. I think that's just incorrect grammar. It's just saying the one loving us, no qualifications, not then, not in the future, not just loving us, hence my use of it here. And I've also used it this way, if you remember when Paul says Christ lives, I live no longer I, but Christ living in me. How does it go on? The life I live in faith is the life of him who loves me, is loving me and giving himself for me. They're both participles too. Though it's usually translated who loved me and gave himself for me. I think it's an incorrect rendition of the participle in Greek. Now I'll go on to my main point. But that's why I've altered it to the one who is loving us. He loved us, he will love us, he's just love. I'm convinced that neither death nor life, two extremes, angels or rulers, is that good angels and bad angels? Is it the lower, you know, little Botticelli's cherubim, cherubs and going up to the seraphs? Big name for all those things we don't know what to name that influence our world, and they had many more ideas on that in the Roman world than we did. Height or depth seems to be the zenith and the nadir, you know, of the cosmos, looking right up and then right down. Nothing in the whole of creation can separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. And that terrific ending ends chapter 8.